Collectivism is based on individualism. It's the idea that the society of mankind and the physical environment beyond it is a collection with nothing of the kind. That's the idea of cosmic flotsam and jetsam that all floated together into a collection. And that's the obverse of individualism. You know, American individualism is the same philosophy as Marxist collectivism, seen from the other side, because they're both based on the same erroneous sensation of individuality. Now, what people don't understand is that a complex and interesting personality is not a matter of being isolated. It's a matter of being deeply connected with and aware of one's relationship to the whole surrounding cosmos. Let's suppose that I'm preparing to make a date with some lady, and she's such an individualist that her thoughts are only occupied with herself. She never thinks about anything that isn't herself. Well, she's an awful bore. She has nothing to say. She's not interested in any books, in any landscapes, in any works of art, in any literature, in any other people. She's a total bore. But the more, on the other hand, she would be interested in all those things that are supposed to be not herself, the more of a colorful personality she becomes. So the rule is to get away, you see, from these ideas of the individual as finding his individuality and uniqueness through independence, but rather finding his individuality and uniqueness through being related. Because, you see, that's what makes us look at the word relation from another point of view when we talk about our friends and relations. Supposing I come across some individual who I can't make out what kind of a thing he is. I can't make out where he came from. His accent isn't American, it isn't British. It isn't particularly Middle Western, it certainly doesn't have the overtones of New York or New England. He just talks flat. And as to his style of clothing, it's utterly nondescript. Well, I think this is pretty much of a bore. What I like to see in an individuality, in a physical individual, is ways that I can relate him to his ancestry. That he has this little subtle accent, or this mannerism, or this eccentricity, or whatever it is that connects him with a great background, you see? But it's his connection with his background that makes him so significant. If I can't see that connection, he becomes uninteresting. So, there is no thought in this approach to devalue the individual. What really does devalue the individual is any kind of religious or political philosophy that overstresses his isolation. And this is something that Californians in particular need to take note of. And because many, many people feel, you see, that the development of technology and of centralized government is a direct threat to the value of personality. Well, in some ways it is. But that is only because technology is being developed by personalities who don't understand what personality is. They're working on the old individualist-collectivist point of view. They're the same. So then, you see, this is then the illusion created that the individual is operating all by himself, that actions and thoughts and deeds proceed solely from inside his skin, so that we can say, there's where it started. You see? Well, that's the game of praising and blaming, the game of who started it, who can we give candy to, who can we bang on the head. In other words, somebody has to be it. As in the farmer in the dell, you know, and finally you get the end, the cheese stands alone, the cheese stands alone. Hi ho, the derry, the cheese stands alone. Well, why? Who started it? The group. Well, another fear about this is that it absolves people of responsibility if they see through the illusion of separateness. The truth of the matter is, actually, that no philosophy of history has really succeeded in making anybody more or less responsible. In other words, let's say that you are a Christian, a Catholic, of the old-fashioned medieval type, who believes that you've got an individual soul with free will, and that you're under responsibility to God to obey his law, and that if you don't, the most disastrous consequences imaginable will befall you. You'll fry in hell forever. There's no evidence whatsoever that believing in that made people any more virtuous than they are today. None at all. Indeed, clergy who believed in all this owned whorehouses and all kinds of things. They were just as contemptuous of law and order as anybody could be now. And part of the reason was, of course, that the threat of hell was an unimaginable penalty, like the H-bomb. It's just too big to think about. And really brings justice into disrespect because it uses such crude and clumsy methods. You know, it's like using a steam hammer to drive in tacks. Responsibility is a thing like a nice face, which you either have or haven't. Certain backgrounds, certain interests, certain awarenesses of relationship create responsibility in some human beings. And they live that way not because they are giving themselves sermons and telling themselves all the time that they ought to be responsible. It's because they're intelligent enough to see that being responsible makes things very much easier for everybody all around. That's all there is to it. And, of course, that's all is a big all, but you won't, in other words, what I'm saying is, the people who are frightened that other people will abandon responsibility never did have any way of thinking that would guarantee that people would be responsible. There is no such guarantee. If there were, we should be automata. Now, I want to switch to another aspect of illusion. The quickness of the hand deceives the eye. And that is, of course, the great illusion of what we call matter. Density, impenetrability, opacity. I find it hard to talk about the illusion of matter because I'm a materialist. That is to say, I like material. And though I may seem to you to be quite self-contradictory. For example, a wine should have body. Pure alcohol doesn't. And it's terribly important in human character for there to be a blend of materialism and mysticism, between sensuality and spirituality. You see, people who are purely sensuous and materialistic get very boring. You can fill your lives with all good things. With Alfa Romeos and hi-fis and wonderful cameras and girls with beautiful bodies and Chris Crafts and dry martinis and Chanel No. 5, you know. And after a while, if that's all you've got, it gets sickening and the bottoms begin to feel like plastic and the martinis taste like medicine. And somehow, blah, you get a distaste for life, and even for mountains and trees and waters. And then on the other hand, the purely spiritual approach to things is too rarefied, too earnest, too abstract, too purely Euclidean. And the people who are intensely spiritual and don't have any sensuality are always desperately serious, colorless, lacking in humor, and never are able to meet one as man to man with a kind of a friendly leer in the eye. That's terribly important. Yes, they live at a level of the frantic intensity. I see these two extremes need each other. Say, spirituality needs a beer and a loud burp, and sensuality needs a rough blanket and a hard bed and a cold night with the stars, you know, to wonder about. The sensualist as such, the materialist as such, has no wonder. And the mystic, the pure mystic, has no body. He's pure alcohol. Spirit. So, if then one should say that material is an illusion, this seems to be selling out to the spirit people and to the mystics. And so Christian Scientists are, generally speaking, as personalities, totally lacking in materialism. And they're prissy and lacking in color, and their churches are very, very disagreeable. They're all reading desks, and they're too bookish, and they have no ritual, no ceremonies, no verve, you see? It's all cerebral. And likewise, when people get the wrong idea about Hinduism or Buddhism, they go into this same ultra-mysticism. They start disbelieving in all material pleasures as crutches. And it's very bad to have crutches, you see. You shouldn't take aspirin when you've got a headache. You shouldn't wear glasses. You shouldn't show dependence on anything. You mustn't like your food too much, because that's becoming gluttonous. So you eat very plain food, which is not spiced, and you eat it out of a sense of duty. That is to keep the body functioning. You drink only water, because other drinks might cause certain dependencies and give you too much pleasure. And because the idea is, you see, you've got to control your mind and keep it absolutely calm and still so that you are not dependent on matter. And that's altogether the wrong approach, because, it is a game you can play. It is one of these possible things. I mean, you can play the Jehovah's Witness game. You can play the three-seed in the Spirit Baptist game. All these are various things which you can play, just as you can take up a hobby for bridge or fishing or something like that. But what happens is, you see, that the notion that the material world is an illusion is turned into a judgment of value. If it's an illusion, therefore it's bad. I ought not to be under this illusion. Well, the reality of the matter is that if you see that the material world is an illusion, you can enjoy it a great deal better than if you think it isn't. A true materialist, therefore, is one who knows that material is an illusion. Then he's not afraid of it. Then he can enter into the dance of material with real zest. Because, you see, if you're a false and a fake materialist, what's happened? You've borrowed money to buy yourself a Cadillac, an impressive house, a ranch style with a picture window and a patio and a swimming pool, and you've bought a lot of stock, and you somehow wangled the money and borrowed it, and you keep lying awake nights wondering if you're going to make the payments. Well, there's no point in that at all. Well, how can you possibly enjoy all this jazz, if that's the kind of jazz you want to enjoy, if you've got to worry about whether you pay for it or not? And you get hopelessly involved, you get commitments here, commitments there, and finally you have a nervous breakdown and shoot yourself. The only way to enjoy material is to disbelieve in it, just as one can disbelieve in money. Then you can have zest for it, you see? Otherwise, it's much better to be poor. I mean, if you have no taste for this kind of life and no real interest in it, but feel that somehow you ought to have it for status reasons, it's much better to stay poor. Not have any of that stuff at all. So, then this is the important thing I'm trying to say. Material is an illusion, but a great illusion. And the point is to swing it and not to run away from it on the one hand or to get stuck on it in the other. Then you can play with it. It's just like a wheel going round. If the wheel is too loose on the axle, it wobbles all over the place. If it's too tight, it won't revolve. But you kind of sit loose, you see, to this thing. Not too loose, though. Now, in what way, then, is the material world an illusion? Well, we know a lot about this now from our physics. And we know that what we call solidity is force, contained force. The agitation of particles or wavicles or whatever they are at such an immense speed that they become impenetrable to other agitations. So that when I put my foot on the floor, the reason it doesn't go through the floor is that the floor is coming into existence and going out of existence so rapidly that there is no interval through which my foot can penetrate. Like an airplane propeller, you can't put your head through it without getting it chopped off. Only that if it were going far faster still, it wouldn't even cut your head off. It would just be like banging your head against a brick wall. And it has to be going fast too within an extraordinarily small and restricted space. The airplane propeller is whizzing around through a considerable space in relation to the size of a head. But if it were going much faster, but through much smaller spaces, you see, then it would be like banging your head against a brick wall. So what we've got in our so-called physical objective world is a behavior of energy where where matter arises from it through its behavior in restricted spaces. Density is a quality of space rather than a quality of matter, if you see what I mean. I gave the illustration of the airplane propeller to try and show that. So that all this is an electronic, diaphanous world. Very similar to other creations of electronic patterns, the dance of forms on the TV screen, the rainbow, the aurora borealis. It's all fundamentally like that. Only we are of the same kind of jazz, you see. Our bodies are this dance too, and therefore the physical world feels real to us. In other words, it feels solid because we are something of the same kind. If we were on a different wavelength, we'd walk right through it. in the same way as radio waves come right through the house. They are of such a nature that they can penetrate the spaces, the interstices, or in some way jazz signals through. And but we are on the same wavelength, you see, as the wall, and so don't go through it. But nevertheless, the whole cosmos is therefore a function of energy, or you could say of light, something like light, and therefore we and it are all diaphanous. Now, it's easier to see that if you live in a medium where things aren't so dense. There's only one other creature as intelligent as man, and this lives